WWPR, Bradenton, Sarasota, Tampa Bay.
I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me, and I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today.
Welcome to the Dr. Rich Show with your host, Rich Swire, on Talk Radio 1490 WWPR. The Dr. Rich Show is your chance to call in and talk about political issues, candidates for office, and their solutions. Call in now, 941-PIC-1490. That's P-I-K 1490. Or 941-745-1490. Now, here's your host, Patriot Dr. Rich Swire.
Well, welcome to the Dr. Rich Show. This is not K Street or J Street or even Wall Street. This is We the People Talk Radio. Sit back. Come on, relax. It is Telling the Truth with Dr. Rich on Florida's beautiful Sun Coast. We're very glad to be back in Florida. We spent the weekend in Rhode Island. Love that place. Very blue state. And it's interesting. I was there for a summit of conservative journalists from across the United States of America. We had them come from California, Florida, all the way East Coast, West Coast, from the northernmost states to the southernmost state. And it was a great time. We had a great group of people, over 100 journalists. We had great speakers talking about many issues. And the big issue was that journalism has failed to tell the truth. I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, Independent, Libertarian, whatever it is. There, at one time in America, there was a belief that the media, whether it was radio or it was TV or it was the print or now on the Internet, that it told the truth. Well, guess what? The media doesn't tell the truth anymore. And that is the key. If you can tell the truth, you will be set free. And one of the people who understands what it means to tell the truth and for his entire adult life grew up in a society that the media did not tell the truth is our guest today, Oleg Atbashian. Oleg is a writer and graphic artist who lived in the former USSR. He was born and raised in Ukraine, and he has been a teacher, a translator, a freelance journalist. And at one time, he was a propaganda artist creating graphical agitprop. I guess that's, artwork that agitates the people for the local party in Siberia. In 1994, he emigrated to the United States, hoping to live in a country that was ruled by reason and common sense, something he did not experience under a socialist regime. He emigrated to New York and has since moved to and lives in Tampa, Florida. He is the creator of a wonderful satirical website. Talk about political satire. It's www, the People's Cube, that's people's plural, cube.com, where he writes under the name of Red Square. Oleg, thanks for being on the Dr. Rich Show.
Hi, Dr. Rich. Good morning.
Well, good morning to you, sir, and to your wonderful wife, Larissa. We appreciate you being on the show. I know you'd rather spend time with her, but we're going to pull you away. By the way, Oleg is the author of a wonderful book that you need to go get right now from Amazon called Shakedown Socialism. Shakedown Socialism. And it's all about unions, pitchforks, collective greed, the fallacy of economic equality, and other optical illusions of redistributive justice. Oleg, in your book, you talk a lot about unions. And, of course, unions are in the news because of Governor Scott Walker overcoming a recall election that was primarily funded by and the impetus from the unions in Wisconsin. What are your thoughts about that election?
Well, of course, I will not be original if I say it's a great win, and it really gives hope that people realized what was going on despite all the propaganda that was unleashed by the unions, and even what is the number? 38% of union households voted against the unions, basically, because and for Governor Walker, because they realized where the truth lies. And again, when I said against the unions, against the interest of the union bosses and against the interests of redistributive ideology. That's what they voted against, not the unions themselves. And like I said, the book that I wrote is not against the unions, unless, of course, you think that the purpose of the unions is to siphon the nation's wealth into the pockets of their neighbors. Then yes, then it is anti-union. But if the unions are there to protect the workers' rights, then it is not the anti-union argument. On the contrary, the more the unions engage the government in regulating the economy, the more the unions try to make the government buy off the politicians so that the politicians would create laws that would replicate what the unions are supposed to do. They're just making their jobs easier, right? And the more that happens, the more the government replaces the unions, the more the unions become in competition with the government. And at a certain point, the unions become redundant. And once the government grows big enough to give you everything you want, it becomes also strong enough and big enough to take everything you have. And that's when the unions are at a disadvantage, and that happened in the USSR, that happened in the Nazi Germany, that happened in every totalitarian regime, where then the government was doing with the workers whatever they had wanted, and there were no unions around to protect them.
You know, in your book, in the former Soviet Union, as you point out very clearly in your book, and you said it, as the unions were absorbed by the government, they became irrelevant. They no longer were really truly representing the people. They lost all their ability to represent the worker, and the government began to fulfill that role and obviously worked against the union. So the more government that you have, the less ability a union worker, the less say the individual union worker actually has in the entire process. Am I wrong about that?
Right. In this sense, the unions are like the snake that is biting its own tail. And at some point, it's going to hurt itself. So it is in the best interest of the union, of the unions, or of the workers, which the unions claim to represent, is to keep the unions small and to keep their functions limited to the original goal, which is the collective bargaining, taking care of workers' training, safety issues, and a few things like that related to a particular work at a particular enterprise, particular location, perhaps taking care of workers' entertainment, because that's what mostly the Soviet trade unions did. They did not engage in political activity at all. They did not oppose any government decision. What they did was organized events, organized vacations. The unions owned different resorts where they would send workers at a big discount. But of course, because the places were limited, you needed to have connections in order to get to those resorts, and eventually it wasn't the workers themselves who were vacationing at those resorts, but people who were on good terms with the union bosses. And that kind of abuse is always bound to happen because there will always be people wanting to take advantage, and there will always be people trying to please somebody else who is useful for their purposes, for the advancement or whatever. And the more you create a situation when this abuse is possible, the more this abuse is going to happen. That's why the government needs to be limited. The more, the bigger the government, the more potential for abuse. There's a direct correlation, whether the unions are involved or not.
Absolutely. Now, I want to differentiate what Oleg is saying. Oleg, there's two kinds of unions, and in America, we have two kinds of unions. We have the private sector union, in other words, a union, for example, that may represent auto workers. And, of course, the auto workers union is designed to make sure that they can collectively bargain to advance their membership in that industry, okay, and that with that particular factory, whether it's Ford or Chrysler or whatever. We also have something in America called the public sector union. But I want to go back to the private sector because I want to spend the rest of some of the other times in the show talking about how the rise of the public sector union, which is, you know, government employees becoming unionized at the federal, state, and local level, and what that means for the future of America. But let's go back to, because you, in your book, you give a marvelous example of a union out of control, and you use the Donbass coal miners as an example. Can you explain what that did to the people? Because it was the unions actually ended up harming the people. Can you explain that a little bit?
Right. You see, what happened with the Donbass coal miners was a model of what always happens everywhere when the unions demand and aim for inflated wages. And the reason why that example is so great is because it is, in a weaker economy on a smaller scale, it gives you an isolated example of how this scheme works. With in the American economy, which is big and complex, sometimes such things get unnoticed, and this massive prosperity allows the companies, the manufacturers, to swallow the cost and kind of compensate for it with price. But in a weakened economy, on a smaller scale, it is much more obvious. So what happened is that the economy was pretty much in shambles in Ukraine after it gained its independence. And, of course, the unions, who were silent before, they were puppets of the Communist Party, and the leadership of the union was all communist. They did not object to any of the abuses of power by the communists, but once the Communist Party was disbanded, then immediately the unions started their activities and impeding the development of the new privatized industries. That was bad enough, but then the coal miners in the area of Donbass in Ukraine realized that they were actually holding the country by the throat because coal was the only source of energy at the time. And actually, it's not the workers themselves, it's the unions who started agitating for raising their salaries. So the workers went with that, and they started a strike. And in the middle of the winter, when the country needs heat, needs energy, suddenly there is a strike and there is no coal coming. So, of course, the demands were met, and immediately the price of coal went up, because the money doesn't come out of nowhere. It has to come from selling the product. And once the price of coal went up, the price of energy went up, and so the price of everything went up that was connected to energy, which is everything. And after this cycle was completed, maybe in a few weeks, the prices went up, and some of the salaries had to be adjusted to the new prices. And again, the workers in the area were at a disadvantage because they weren't better off than everybody else. With their new inflated wages were compensated by the newly inflated prices. So they went on strike again, and again their wages were raised, and again the same cycle completed, and the prices went up, and everybody else's salaries were raised, adjusted, although maybe not as much as their own. And again, they didn't feel like they're at an advantage, and they went on strike again. So after a series of strikes, the prices became so high that pensioners, for instance, had no way to survive. Everybody became so poor whose salaries were not adjusted. But the workers, coal miners, life standard didn't improve because the prices also were adjusted accordingly to their inflated wages. And eventually the country entered what was called hyperinflation. So everybody became millionaires. The dream of the coal miners was fulfilled. Everybody had billions of dollars, of rubles, but at the same time, the price of bread was also like 100,000, and so in order to go shopping, you needed to carry large wads of cash in your pockets, and sometimes it wouldn't even fit in the pockets. You would have to carry like a plastic bag filled with cash in order to go do groceries. And at some point, my wife called a repairman to fix the refrigerator. And he charged ₹1 million for fixing the refrigerator in the kitchen, which was an old, like 20-year-old, malfunctioning monster. So that's how unreasonable, inflated union wages work. They don't do anybody any good, and they show explicitly how these demands for unreasonable price increase are nothing but the desire to live at everybody else's expense and to siphon the money out of everybody's pockets into their own. And that's what the unions do. Instead of doing what they were originally meant to do for what they were created, they are just they're engaging in shakedown like the mafia. And that's why I called my book Shakedown Socialism. And that's not just the unions. Everything related to socialism is about shakedown, because that's what the government does to people.
Exactly. And that's such a perfect example under a socialist system. And we see it, by the way. We have seen it in various industries across America. You know, the car industry is probably one of the most vivid examples of how unions will strike against one automaker, and then when that automaker and shut down that automaker's plants, and mm-hmm. and that automaker, because they're being shaken down and realize that as their plants are shut down, their competitors, say they shut down Chrysler, the other ones are still producing cars, so they start to lose market share, and then they because of the shakedown, they decide to give the union worker additional benefits, raise their salary, and so on. And then as soon as that happens, as soon as Chrysler signs a new contract, then the union goes to the other car manufacturers and via shakedown saying, well, look, Chrysler did it. You need to do it as well. And what ends up happening is our cars become overly inflated. The price of the car is overly inflated, and who pays for that? Well, obviously, right. The person who pays for that are you and I when we buy a car. So, you know, our cars become less competitive, and other nations are importing cars cheaper than we can manufacture them here. So we have that same situation now. And now, what's interesting, by the way, we have with us Oleg Adbashian, who is the brilliant author of a book called Shakedown Socialism. He is also the creator and of the great website, great satire, thepeoplescube.com, www.thepeoplescube.com. And he writes on that website under the name of Red Square. When we come back from this break, Oleg, I want to talk about public sector unions, because it's public sector unions that I think are implementing shakedown socialism on the Dr. Rich Show, WWPR, AM 1490.
Hello, I'm Glenn Pav, President and CEO of the Conservative Talk Network and the Dr. Rich Show. I've coined the phrase, righting the right, to encourage us to move our country back to the right of center on the political and moral spectrum, the very place our founding fathers lived. Each letter, R-I-G-H-T, explains our stance. The G stands for godliness. Godliness is not only a work of faith, but also a state of mind. Prayer is absent from our schools. The Ten Commandments are being removed from our hallowed halls of justice. The American flag is being disrespected by protesters on American soil. The Pledge of Allegiance, including one nation under God, is gradually silenced throughout the land. Offensiveness and political correctness are empty reasons for these removals. God will not push his way into our lives, my friend. He said, "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land." 2 Chronicles 7:14. Yes, my friend, let's humble ourselves, pray, seek him, and turn toward reformation from wickedness. I'm Glenn Pav of the Conservative Talk Network. With godliness, let's keep righting the right.
Are you thinking about doing something with a mortgage? Don't know who or what to ask or who you can trust? You have to be real careful. If you're thinking about a mortgage for purchasing or refinancing a home, or are 62 or older and considering a reverse mortgage to live on the home's equity, you should call the Center for Sound Consumer Advice, Incorporated. They're still the only consumer advocacy referral service in America where there has never been a fee or charge to consumers for the Today in America series of free consumer protection guides. They can even help you arrange a free consultation with a licensed mortgage professional in your area who is a member of the Center-sponsored LendingAllianceUSA.com. There are guides for purchasing and refinancing homes, reverse mortgages for seniors 62 or older, and even a guide about credit restoration. Call the Center today to arrange for your choice of any or all of their guides, or for a consultation. Call 1-800-593-6406. That's 1-800-593-6406.
Welcome back to the Dr. Rich Show, where this is radio of the people, by the people, and for the people. And we're talking with a very special person, our good friend Oleg Apashian. Oleg, of course, is a writer and graphic artist. He runs the great website, thepeoplescube.com. He's the brains behind it. He created it. It's a magnificent site. I recommend you go see it. And he obviously writes under the name of Red Square. He is a former that was actually born in Ukraine, and he was actually at one time a propaganda artist for the former Soviet Union, and created propaganda for the local Communist Committee in Siberia. Oleg, when we were talking about private sector unions, and that's how private sector unions are good in the sense that, as long as they stay to their role of working with the companies that their workers are involved in, that's fine. But when they begin to inflate the cost of goods to the point where they gain nothing and the people actually lose, that becomes problematic. Let's talk a little bit. Let's talk a little bit now about public sector unions, because we have in America. And it wasn't that way, and only recently, actually, did we, 40 or 50 years ago, did we begin to see public sector unions like the SEIU. And again, In my mind, we see the same thing. The leadership becomes very radical and moves away from the basic function of a union and, if you will, uses the union for political purposes. What are your thoughts about that?
Right. But first, let me clarify a few things about the private unions, that they wouldn't be able to achieve their goal of unreasonably inflating the wages and the benefits of the union workers if they didn't pay off the politicians and they didn't have the government on their side. So they are creating a situation when the government creates all kinds of regulations that stifle the businesses that where the workers work at. And so they disadvantage the workers by pushing those industries out of existence. And remember how the unions are always complaining about the works, the jobs going overseas. But it is their own creation, because if they hadn't priced the product of that their workers are producing out of the market, then those jobs would still be in the United States. People would still be getting less money, but then the prices would also be lower. So it would still be exactly the same life. I mean, maybe even better and more fair life, because then non-union workers would not be paying for the union benefits. So that's the situation that is not acceptable. And when it comes to the public unions, it's even worse, because public is a good euphemism for them. It's the government union workers, and it's a very actually clarifies a few things without having to explain it when you say government union, not the public sector. The government doesn't produce anything. The government doesn't have a profit margin. When you negotiate with a company that produces something like automobiles or some tools, machinery, then every item has a price, and so the managers of the factory, for example, they can say, okay, here is our profit margin. These are the prices that we cannot go over, and here is how much we can pay the workers and how much we can contribute to their pension plans and benefits, and not more than that, because we'll go out of business. With the government, it's different. There is no profit margin. They cannot say no government official can cite a profit margin and explain why these wages or pension plans or benefits are unreasonable, because there is no market for that. And that's one of the reasons why public or government sector unions shouldn't exist at all. They they do not produce anything, they do not manufacture anything. So the primary goals of the unions, the actual reasons for their existence, isn't present there. They're just replicating existing model from the private sector, and they go take it from there. And what they do is basically try to make the life of their members enjoyable by inflating their wages and their benefits and pensions. But not just that. That is only a means to an end, but the actual end of public or government sector unions is to participate in political and ideological battles that are happening right now in the country. That's all they do. There is not a single public sector union in existence that is not a radical far left. And they are operating based on that ideology, and they are basically the agents of radical socialism or communism or whatever you can call that ideology, collectivist ideology that they're promoting. Even when public sector unions are also susceptible to that, is still they are limited in their range of goals. But the public sector unions are not. They are going all the way, and they are the most active participants in all the hard left radical activities in this country, from voting to paying off politicians, from spreading the propaganda, from organizing protests and public displays. And that propaganda that they're spewing is pretty much reminds me what existed in the USSR. And the public sector unions are now taking, like SEIU, are taking a very active role in Occupy protests. And if you have seen the Occupy propaganda posters recently, you would, I don't know, if you're familiar with the Soviet propaganda, you would immediately recognize the, they're directly borrowing from what the Soviet propaganda did. And it's not a coincidence that they are so enamored with it, because their ideology is very similar. Because what propaganda does is it simplifies life, it creates two-dimensional representations of people, and it's basically flattening an individual under an ideological press, and it squeezes out all the person's humanity and leaving some single superficial trait that is portrayed on the picture, whether it's his representative of a class or a gender or a race or some profession or ethnicity. Such art establishes a simplified two-dimensional vision of the world in the minds of the target audiences. And, you know, I'm just approaching it from the point of view of an artist, but you get the idea that the public sector unions are nothing but tools in the fight for turning America into one big collectivist, socialized entity where the government runs everything.
Yeah, and usually when that happens, as you point out very clearly in your book, whether it's a what you call a government union, which is an interesting situation, or a union in the private sector, eventually they all become absorbed by the government. They lose their power, and it's the government, the selected few, the anointed few who become the tyrants, decide what the wage is, what jobs are given, what jobs are not given. And one of the things you talked about that's very troubling to people across America, and we're seeing it in cities, that are going bankrupt. Detroit is probably the most recent example. What's interesting is Detroit is not used to be the richest city in the in the nation. Why was
it?
And the world, for that matter, at one time. And why was that? Because it had what? Auto industry. And what's happened? It is going bankrupt. It's going bankrupt because the private sector unions that were negotiating with the car dealers, and this is a perfect example of Oleg's message in his great book, Shake Down Socialism. Immediately go on Amazon or Google Shake Down Socialism, and with Oleg Atbashian, it's Atbashian. This is the perfect epicenter. If you want to show the picture, the poster child of how public and private sectors working together have bankrupted a city, Detroit is probably the best example. It's the auto industry in America is on the downslide. The city, and because of that, the city lost money from all of its revenue sources. At the same time, the public sector unions, what you call government union, was increasing its benefits and its salaries, including its retirement plans, if you will. And that combination is literally bankrupting the city of Detroit. What's your thoughts about that, Olga? It's a perfect example that you pointed out in your book.
Right, and I cited two examples of Hiroshima that was destroyed in 1945 with a nuclear weapon, and now it's been rebuilt, and it's a rich, beautiful, shining city. But it was rebuilt under a different principle with a free market and capitalist economy and relationships. And Detroit, which used to be rich under the system of free economy and capitalism and free enterprise, but not anymore, that system has been replaced with the union dictate, and it's been so much socialized that now Detroit resembles Hiroshima of 1945. And the weapon that has been unleashed on it, that destroyed that city, is much worse than the nuclear weapon, because the nuclear bomb only killed, destroyed, did the physical destruction, but then people rebuilt after that. What this weapon that was unleashed on Detroit, called the idea of economic equality and justice, quote-unquote, that thing is much worse, because it destroys the human spirit and the human idea of innovation and self-improvement, because you do not need to strive to achieve anything, because there is some entity that's taking care of you just because you're a member. So your individual traits, your individual achievement doesn't matter. And so that's when the spiritual destruction follows, and after that, the material destruction will also follow the physical destruction, inevitably. And that is cannot be rebuilt. There has to be a new generation of people who will move in and build it under a different principle. The generation of people who allowed this destruction to happen are not going to rebuild anything, unless, of course, they realize how wrong their ways are. And here's where we come to this idea of socialism in general, what it does. They try to divide the population into different groups and claim that they would represent, who they, you know, in our case it's the unions, but also the leftist leaders, the leftist politicians, the ideologues, the demagogues. After they divide the nation into all these groups and assign a certain set of grievances to every group and claim that only they, these leaders, can represent them and achieve, lead them to success, then it's over. The groups begin to fight for benefits, entitlements. They are pulling the blanket on each other. They are basically shaking down each other, and it becomes a shakedown society. And there is no creation of wealth anymore, because all those people who still continue to work according to their old ways, they are the ones there that the cows that is being milked by all those crooks and demagogues. So there is basically no wealth creation anymore, and the economy becomes a zero-sum game, if you're familiar with the term, what a zero-sum game is. It's when, instead of capitalist free markets creating additional wealth, in zero-sum, no wealth is being created, it is just being divided by slices, like a pie. And so the more participants in that game, the smaller the slices are, and the more some group gets, the more slices one individual or a group gets, the less is left for everybody else. And that's the mindset of the socialists. That's why they claim that if, for instance, America is the richest country, that means that it's at the expense of the rest of the world. That somebody else is poor. It's like they created this kind of magic principle that the more food exists in America, the more food magically disappears in third world countries. But that's not the case. The food does not disappear and travel to America. It's just Americans are able to create it. And in other countries that live under a different system, that food just is not being created. And people just work unproductively if they work at all. And that's one aspect of it. Another one is that under socialism, there is no price creation mechanism. It is only the free markets that can create prices. In the Soviet Union, the government, that the central planners who were in charge of the economy, they had would have no idea how much things cost if there was no Western capitalist economies to learn from. So they figured with the old products, they kind of knew how much it costs traditionally. But when the new products are created or new services, or because there is always progress in that on that front, they had no idea how much to charge for anything or how much to pay people for doing that. So they were looking at the Western countries and learning from that and taking the lead in that. I spoke to an energy broker from Connecticut once, and he said that their state once abandoned the system of brokers, and the energy companies were just supplying energy directly to the customers at the rates that the government determined. And after a while, they had to abandon that practice because they thought that those brokers were just mediators and the middlemen, and there were just an additional expense. But turns out it wasn't, because after with the brokers, the energy companies didn't know how much to charge their customers.
Well,
and,
listen.
They had no idea whether they were operating at a loss or at a profit. So eventually they reinstituted that system. And that's a good example on a small scale of how inefficient socialism is on a bigger scale.
Well, we're going to come back after the break and talk with Oleg about the bigger picture. We think global, but talk local. With our good friend Oleg Atbashian, who now lives in the beautiful city of Tampa and is fighting the good fight on Dr. Rich Show, WWPRAM 1490.
Hello, I'm Glenn Pav, President and CEO of the Conservative Talk Network and the Dr. Rich Show. I've coined the phrase, righting the right, to encourage us, our country, back to the right of center on the political and moral spectrum, the very place our founding fathers lived. Each letter, R-I-G-H-T, explains our stance. The R stands for Reformation. The Protestant Reformation of the 16th century began as a movement of individuals, both laymen and clergy, whose faith and witness inspired thousands to restore sound biblical Christianity to the people of all nations, based upon the truth of the gospel according to God's holy word. Today, the gift of this godly heritage is being challenged by many factors and may not survive intact beyond this generation. Today, we need a spiritual revival of the soul and a political reformation of the mind. I'm Glenn Pav of the Conservative Talk Network. With Reformation, let's keep righting the right.
Is it just me, or do you agree? It seems like everyone's suffering financially. Even the U.S. government is having problems with its credit. It's just a mess out there. How about you? Are you having financial trouble like over 65 million Americans at this time? Having a low credit score can affect you in so many ways, from employment opportunities to purchasing or refinancing a home to buying a new car or even just opening a bank account. If you're thinking about restoring your credit, that's a smart thing to do. But be careful. Before you do anything, call the Center for Sound Consumer Advice Incorporated, still the only consumer advocacy referral service in America, where since 2004 there has never been a fee of any kind to consumers. Call toll-free today, 800-819-6543, and get your free guide to credit restoration. Learn what you need to know before you do anything. So call today, 800-819-6543, for your free guide to credit restoration. Gain knowledge, become aware, and help yourself and your family recover financially. That's 800-819-6543, 800-819-6543.
Welcome back to the Dr. Rich Show. We are a proud member of the Conservative Talk Radio Network, WWPR, AM 1490. You can also follow us on the drrichshow.com. Again, we have with us our great friend and Tampa resident, Oleg Atbashian. He is a writer and graphic artist. He runs the website, thepeoplescube.com, where it's a satirical website. If you go there, you'll just laugh your sides off. And he writes or blogs under the name Red Square. Oleg, your book, Chapter 6, is very powerful. It's called, the title of the chapter is The Fallacy of Economic Equality. And I'm going to quote from page 89. I think it's a marvelous quote. Quote, this is what Oleg said. Man is brilliant. Quote, if some people had wings and others didn't, and the government wanted to enforce fairness, soon no one would have wings, because wings cannot be redistributed. They can only be broken, unquote. What a wonderful way of putting it. You know, the Occupy movement and President Obama believes that we have to have fairness. We have to impose economic equality. We have to redistribute the wealth. He said that before he was elected. In 2008, he implemented it since he's been elected. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that on the surface seems like a nice goal, you know, make everybody equal, but and equal not in terms of their rights or equal of opportunity, make them equal in terms of results, achieve the equality of outcomes, equality of results. And no matter how hard you try or how little you try or if you don't try at all, notice how people who always demand the equal pay for equal work never protest against equal pay for little or no work at all. There will always be people who will try to slack off, and when you look at those, you will also not want to work hard and slack off too. So the redistribution wealth is immoral if you think about it, because what's fair, what's just, the economic justice in reality is giving everybody according to their work. And if you work hard and you sacrificed your bodily pleasures and you forced yourself to stay up late and keep working, then of course you deserve more. And those who relaxed and didn't do much and enjoyed their lives, they deserve to have less of that material, those material goods. And it would be unfair if those who enjoyed life and like the grasshopper jumping around, they would get exactly the same amount of goods as the ant who worked hard and built his anthill. You know, remember that tale about the grasshopper and the ant. So what Obama and this whole idea of economic equality is to make the ant and the grasshopper equal. And then, but what happens is that the grasshopper is not going to work again. And then in that situation, the ant will also quit working. And then where will the wealth come from to redistribute? It won't. There won't be any. But even with that, even if it were possible to redistribute everything equally, there would still be no equality, because on the one hand, people are all different. They have all different ambitions and different aspirations, and they also work not just for themselves, but their families and their children. And every parent wants their children to have a better chance, to have an upper hand, to advance in life, and so they're trying hard to build that platform for their children. Now, if you enforce economic equality, that means that that desire to make life better for the children becomes in conflict with the idea of equality, because you are not supposed to make your child better off than anybody else's child. So you have to stifle your own human nature, your virtues, and do not provide for your children in order for them to become equal with those children who are less provided. And which, that's a bad situation when there are parents who do not care about their children. It's true, but that doesn't mean that all other children shouldn't be taken care of. But That is just one aspect why economic equality is impossible, because even in the USSR, the people who were in charge of enforcing economic equality, they were making an exception for themselves and for their children. They were trying to provide a better life for their children, and their children were much better off than everybody else's. That's one thing. In practice, it's not working. Also, there will always be thugs and crooks and antisocial elements who will try to take advantage. Even if, imagine there is some idealistic society where everybody is working for the common good and they all equally sacrifice, they will create these positions in the government redistributing the public wealth, because, you know, there always has to be a redistribution system of some sort in lieu of free markets. But no matter how honest and good-willing those people in charge of the system would be initially, eventually they will always be replaced by the crooks and the thugs and the swindlers who see the advantage of being in charge of redistribution. And that's always happens. That happened in the USSR and in any other country that was run by a distribution system. And you can also see abuses of that system now that is being created in this country. There is this gigantic slush fund that the Obama administration is in charge of. They convinced everybody that the stimulus is going to be good. We need to redistribute the money and help some businesses. But it is they who decide which businesses to help and what is the criteria. If business donates to the re-election campaign of Obama, then that business is being helped. If it doesn't, it doesn't. So that's here you have a crime and criminal scheme right there. But also notice how those companies who are taking the money from the government then go bankrupt and the money disappears. And that's another example of a swindle that's happening with the redistribution system when people agreed to an idea that they thought was initially good, but that system became corrupt. I mean, it cannot be not corrupt. It will always be corrupt. And that is why it shouldn't be there at all. And the government should be limited. There was always government is inevitable evil. And the less we still need the government to maintain the army to protect us, to protect the borders, to protect the nation. We need the government to maintain the courts so that the contracts are enforced, so that no thug or crook or swindler can take advantage of other people. And so there has to be the police, because to protect us from thugs, there have to be courts, there has to be the army, and that's the function of the government. And of course there will even be abuses in that system, but let's limit it to that. Everything else beyond that is not what the government should be doing. It shouldn't be engaged in the economy. It shouldn't be engaged in education. It shouldn't be engaged in healthcare and housing. And the free markets did wonderful jobs achieving, creating prosperity for this country and achieving this unprecedented economic growth. Once the free markets were slowed down and impeded or removed in some cases, that's when you saw how this all prosperity is going down and crumbling down, and the more the country is being run by corrupt politicians. And as I also mentioned in the book, notice how, again, on smaller scale examples, in Africa, for example, where economies are pretty small, the governments are fighting, I mean, the people are fighting to be in charge of the government, because those governments usually own everything in the country with nationalized resources. There isn't much to earn, to own there. Everybody is pretty poor. And the main thing that the government owns is natural resources, whether it's oil or gold or diamonds. And then all kind of wars start to erupt, civil wars. When one faction is fighting with another faction, And basically what they're fighting about is the ownership of those resources. But it's, the government shouldn't own those resources. If you remove that ownership of gold and diamonds and oil from the hands of the government, then there will be no desire on part of those political factions and thugs and the local military to be in charge. Who would need, who would want to fight to be at the head of a limited government who doesn't own anything and whose only objective is to maintain the courts and the justice and the police and the army? There is no profit in that. There is no wealth for that. So free markets are actually antithetic to totalitarianism. They're antithetic to wars. Capitalists are not interested in wars. They're interested in prosperity. They want the markets to expand. They want the whole world to be prosperous so that they could sell their products, they could trade, or they could buy products elsewhere to sell at home. The more there is prosperity, the better off the capitalists are, and the better off the people are as a result. So the claim of the socialists or the communists or the leftists in general that capitalism is the one who creates wars is completely wrong. The driving force behind all wars has always been collectivism. Collectivist ideologies like communism or Nazism or nationalism or any kind of other collectivist idea, that's been the driving force behind all the big destructions in the 20th century, starting with the 19th century, actually. Well, before that, there were the wars were created by the overlords, the kings, who were just not satisfied enough with what they already had. But they, again, socialism is just a replication of a feudal society on a larger scale.
Well, you know what? You have hit this on the hit the nail on the head, and that's why founding fathers understood that individual property ownership and literally physically land ownership. If the government owns all the land, if they own all the natural resources, if they own the water, if they own the air, they own everything, then that leads to conflict. And I fear, Oleg, that right now we're in a situation where, sadly, in America, we have more people that vote for a living than work for a living. And when we hit that tipping point, we will enter a socialist system. Oleg, we only have about a minute or two. How can people get a hold of you? How can they find out about your website? How they can contribute, make your life better?
Well, I wouldn't mind making my life better because I'm spending way too much time writing and making my satirical graphics on the People's Cube and not enough to work to pay my bills. So if somebody wants to contribute to buy stuff at my online store on peoplescube.com or buy T-shirts or mugs or posters or buy my book or just send a donation through PayPal, it's also the button is there. The People's Cube.com is my website, and Shakedown Socialism is the book. And you can also order it autographed directly from me, and you will find that link on the website as well. There is a website called ShakedownSocialism.com, and there is also ThePeople'sCube.com.
Well, we appreciate having Oleg on the show. He's a man of great knowledge and understanding. Please tune in Monday through Friday from 11 to noon Eastern Standard Time to the Dr. Rich Show. I wish everyone a grand day.
If you'd like to learn more about Righting the Right and the Dr. Rich Show, go to drrichshow.com. That's drrichshow.com or conservativetalknetwork.org. Join us again every weekday at 11.